This is Phil Pritchett. Welcome to the P2 Podcast.
There's never been a better time than right now to be a musician. Giddy hit Austin. My name's Phil, and I just want to play rock and roll, man.
Tougher than the rest.
There's a southern accent where I come from. The young ones call it country, the Yankees call it dumb. I got my own way of talking, and every word's begun with a southern accent where I come from.
Fans, Romans, countrymen, lend me your ears. It is Phil Pritchett on the P2 Podcast, enlightening your musical life. That's right, folks. Every week from right here in beautiful Trinidad World Recording Studios, my studio here in Fort Worth, I sit surrounded by the cedar emblazoned walls, vintage instruments, amps, drums, the telltale Indian rugs strewn about the floor, emitting warmth, emitting comfort, the rack of vinyl records over here. Oh, I just put myself in this mood every week. This zen-like state where I can sit here and talk to all of you, my friends, about music, about what is going on out there, making the living, keeping it all going. Living isn't an easy thing to do, as the old song says. Well, well, well. I hope you're all doing great out there. Did you know here in a little bit, our good friend Blake Walker, he's been seen out in the parking lot, you know, kind of looking in the windows of cars, just seeing if there's anything. I've seen if the car doors are locked, just rummaging around out there. In a minute, I'm going to go get him to join us for our second segment, because last week I told him to come back because I said, look, man, next week, for your benefit, we'll do a Pritchett timeline. He's always asking me, and I get a lot of emails from you out there. God bless you all. Thanks for emailing in. Phil@philpritchett.com. Do it anytime. But y'all been emailing me in. Phil, a friend of mine says, hey, he went to college with you, and you were in this band, and hey, you know, I had an old recording of a high school band of yours, or I think it was yours, or whatever. So we're going to kind of lay some of these stories to rest. True or false, we're just going to kind of lay it all out there. I'm going to give you sort of in our middle segment, that's what we'll do when Walker comes in here. I'm going to guide him through the Phil Pritchett chronology of events, a quick timeline of what bands I was in, what we were called, what we were playing, and how that got us to where we are today with Stu and Blue, the full band for you out there, folks. Out there making the rounds as we do every weekend. And we love it. So look forward to that in our second segment, Blake Walker. Well, summer is coming down. It's just winding down here. I don't know if you're like me, man, but I always read a lot in the summer. I'm always in Colorado, chilling out, no TV around up there. So I always take a lot of books, man. I always pack up on the reading. I haven't gotten into like the Kindle, the iPad reading. Let me know what you think of that, man. A lot of discussion on there. The pros and cons. You know, I don't know. I assume it's something we'll all do eventually. But I haven't read the digital book yet. The electronic book. I don't know. Still like the old books. I hit the half-price books frequently. History section, etc. The old paper, man. Give me a bound volume over something I'm reading on a screen any day. But who knows? Maybe that's Some a bygone era. Man, did you see Barnes & Noble going out? He's in trouble, in trouble. Barnes & Noble. Of course, no one buys anything. I've noticed this for years. I'm like, they got all these CDs in here no one buys. Then you got all these books that no one buys. Everybody just comes in here and drinks coffee and walks around. That's what I do anyway. It's a nice air-conditioned place to take the kids. You go into the children's bookstore thing. You read about 8 books. They climb around on the stuff. Then you put the books back and you go home. Should I feel guilty about that? That's how I always treated it. Barnes & Noble's kind of like a park or something. Yeah, but they're in trouble, I saw. Oh, man, I read some stuff. I read Barron's, the Wall Street Journal. I try to keep up with what's going on. My dad, the great Phil Pritchett Sr., subscribes to the Wall Street Journal, Barron's, all the great financial magazines. And so he always brings me like a stack of like 4 or 5 of the latest editions, you know. Brings them over to the office here. I rummage through anything that catches my eye. I always got a few things I read there. But, yeah, man, summer reading list. So I went up to, Colorado, reading some books, rummaging through things. Finished up that Lewis and Clark book, a little summer reading. Oh, great stuff there. Stephen Ambrose. Oh, has he been disgraced? You know of whom I speak. Stephen Ambrose, the great historian. Wrote Band of Brothers. Do you remember that whole miniseries on HBO or whatever they had? Band of Brothers, World War II. The Lewis and Clark book. What's it called? Undaunted Courage. Undaunted Courage, great stuff. But man, he was recently kind of, he's since passed. Some of his old Eisenhower interviews, he had written extensively on Dwight D. Eisenhower, biographies, all kinds of things. And I don't know, someone had called in a question like how much time maybe he'd actually spent with old Ike. I was sad to see that. Don't know how true it is. I remember seeing a thing on there that, you know, some of the Eisenhower family had said, well, we don't know really if he did do all those interviews with him and stuff like that. So who knows? Anyway, Undaunted Courage. Ambrose, still worth a great read. I don't think there's any mystery or controversy surrounding that book. So check it out. But I want to talk to you about a book I just finished here recently. As we veer off the music subject here, but you know, we talk a lot of music business here. Because it is a business, man. You got to figure, everybody's always talking about, man, is anyone going to buy CDs anymore? Is anyone going to go, what's with the touring industry? What's with the label industry? It's all up in the air. The economy. How do you make it work, man? Well, for some perspective, I turned to the highly touted recent book by Michael Lewis, who wrote, we all know The Blind Side, the movie. He wrote that. He also had a book called Moneyball and another book called Liar's Poker. He used to be a Wall Street guy, worked for Solomon Brothers in the 80s. Well, his new book has gotten a lot of attention. It's called The Big Short. The Big Short, and it attempts to explain, and does pretty good job in my opinion, the financial crisis that we find ourselves sitting in. The bust of the mortgage, the subprime mortgage lending, and all that stuff. Which, if you're like me, you're just scratching your head, saying, what the hell is all this? What are you talking about? Well, man, I feel like it's my role as some sort of an observer of our times, a guy that writes songs and things. You got to understand these things a little bit. I don't know. Always try to read, always try to learn, always try to read history and get some perspective, you know. I mean, how are you supposed to write lyrics on a song or something? I'm always trying to look for something to tie it back to, you know, something old, something true, something historically proven, right? No? Rather than just shooting off some lyrics that don't mean anything, you know. You're trying to look for some sort of universal, profound truth on something, you know. So to do that, you got to read a little bit, man. You got to learn about your times and stuff like that. I was a history major in college, so not that that qualifies me to do anything, but I'm just interested. I'm interested. So The Big Short, Michael Lewis, what do we have here? Man, well, a few of these guys saw this bust coming, or thought they did. And man, it's very fascinating. This book just talks about the very few people, traders, who bet against the subprime mortgage industry. A subprime loan, of course, is just a bank lending out money below the prime level of interest. Low interest loans to people who probably couldn't pay them back. That's a gross generalization of what it is. But, and then, of course, when the economy sort of tanked and housing, their foreclosures went up as a result of these loans, the housing industry has collapsed and all this kind of stuff. Oh, man, it's confusing. And I asked myself, I had to read pages of this book over and over again as it explained the types of loans and all this stuff. But basically, you have a couple of just very general things going on. You've got people who can't afford to buy a house being given lots of money by a bank to go buy a house. And then you've got the banks and the investment banks and the government and everybody else trying to shuffle these notes around to keep everything floating. Because all these guys make money on, you know, selling the bonds and selling the loans to other people. So there's a lot of blame to pass around when this whole thing burst, when the whole thing came crashing down. When it was discovered, in fact, that someone with no money can't afford a house, given a certain interest rate, it all went bust, man. So you got two modes of thinking out there, as far as I can tell. And email me, phil@philpritchard.com. Let me know where I'm wrong, because I'm just trying to figure this thing out like you. I'm a musician, for crying out loud. I'm not a financial Wall Street whiz. I'm just doing my best with the information I've given here. You basically have the guys on the left saying, see, all these greedy banks and capitalists, the market, capitalism has failed. Look at this big crash. This is where the greed and the profit making gets you. Nowhere. And then over here on the right, you've got guys going, you see, when the government gets involved in the practices of lending and housing and stuff like that, this is what happens. So that both got their argument. They both have their argument, right? At the heart of this is the banks making loans, bad loans to people who can't pay them back. And the book is all written about how these guys swapped the bonds, they were making money, you know, selling this, selling that. And basically these few traders, Greg Littman, a guy at Deutsche Bank, and this guy Mike Burry, who had a hedge fund, and this guy Steve Eisman had a hedge fund, like-minded guys in different parts of the universe who saw this thing coming. And they started dealing in what became known as credit default swaps. You know, they started buying insurance on bonds that they thought would go bad. So when these when this package of bad mortgage notes, when they couldn't get paid off, they would be holding this credit default swap and say, aha, we're going to go to AIG and get our money. Hey, this failed. I need my $5 billion, you know. So that's what happened. That's what happened here. And it's very, very complicated. It's a tough read. It's told very well. It's kind of in a storybook fashion. You get to know these guys a little bit and what they're thinking. And these interviewed all these guys and done a lot of research. I lack the background in Wall Street terminology and etiquette, but it's still enjoyable, even if you don't understand it all. But my deal kind of comes down to this, kind of back to the very basic argument of, hey, man, this all happened because of capitalism. This all happened because of too much government regulation. This whole thing happened because of not enough government regulation. But the one question that was not addressed in the book that I kept asking myself is, why ever would a bank make a loan that they knew probably wouldn't get paid back? That is kind of the, for me, a very fundamental question. You had all these banks anxious to lend this money to people. They're like, well, they're just greedy. They're getting the money on the train. I'm like, I know, but they're sending $200,000-$300,000 out the door to buy this guy a house who's never had a job, who has no, is not proving any income. I mean, the bank's not going to get paid back. Why would you ever do that in your business? Well, you say to yourself, silly Phil, someone's underwriting this whole deal. The loan is secured. In 1977, you had the Community Restructuring Act. Was it under the Carter administration? That was an act that was passed by Congress that said, hey, all you banks out there that are insured by us, FDIC or whatever, you can't take deposits in this community, maybe a poor community, maybe a lower income community, and then when they come to you to ask for a loan, not give them a loan. You need to lend to those who are working at your bank. course, the bank said, dude, this guy can't afford a house. The bank said they don't have the credit rating high enough for us to, we're not going to send this guy out the door with 250 grand and a house. He's not going to be able to pay us back. Well, what happened then? The 1977 Act said, well, no, you need to have a certain percentage of notes on your book. It was mandated by the government to say, well, you've got to lend a certain number of people these types of notes so they can have housing. And the bank's like, okay, but where do we go to get paid if this guy doesn't pay us? Well, that's where it gets very interesting. You have the Federal Housing Administration, is that what it is, the FHA. They say, well, look, we'll back you up. If some of these guys can't pay it, just come to us and we'll pay it. And that was done through a lot of organizations, from what I can tell. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, stuff like that. Maybe I'm wrong on that. I don't know how closely they are tied to the government. But man, the bottom line is the government was backing this. Think about it. No bank. Would you lend $1,000 to some dude that you didn't know? He said, hey, I'll pay you back $1,000 plus 20% interest. You might say, oh, okay, cool. If you really thought the guy'd pay you back, you make 20% on that money in a given period of time. Say it's 2 years or something. But if you just knew the guy lived in his car, would you just give him $1,000 and say, all right, he'll pay me back. He's good for it. Of course not. So man, at some level, the government is involved. They're underwriting all this stuff to make the banks whole and to get people housing and all that kind of stuff. So, and then it looks like the problem is these traders know this. They know that, look, this is all backed by the government. And not only that, we're smarter here at Goldman Sachs. We got the smartest guys here. We're smarter than any government regulator. They're not going to catch on to how fast we're doing this stuff. So they know it's all good, that the risk is being, spread out, backed by Uncle Sam. And who's that, you ask? That's you and me, dude. So who ends up bailing out all these guys, and covering all the mortgages and all that? Everyone's like, well, the government. Where does the government get their money? They got to tax it. They got to go get it from somebody, or they have to borrow it. Am I right or am I wrong? So, man, there's enough blame to go around for everybody. But I think if you just went back, man, when my parents bought a house in early 70s or something, I mean, it was just, man, you had to put 20% down, and your interest rate was like 15%. It was just an expensive thing. A house was not a cheap deal. Look at this now. I mean, you just have no money down, interest rate's 3%. They want everybody to have a house. What happens, man? You just end up with a bunch of houses no one can afford. Eventually, someone has to pay. It's like a friend of mine who bought a TV at Best Buy for $3,000, but he just got a Best Buy credit card and never had to make a payment on it. But he got the TV. Well, Best Buy reports, hey, we sold a $3,000 TV today. The stock goes up, But man, there was never any money transacted. But at some point, the rubber meets the road, man, and someone's left without a chair when the music stops. Someone's got the old maid. Anyway, The Big Short. Check it out. Let me know what you think. Phil at philpritchard.com. We're going to get Blake Walker in here to talk about what is going on in his world. Actually, we're going to talk about what's going on in Phil world, man, for the last, good grief, 20 years. We're going to reach way back, go through Phil history, the bands, the music, what we were doing. Walker wants a little Phil Pritchett and the full band chronology of events. High school, college, what kind of stuff was I playing in? There's all kinds of CDs and stuff I recorded. Check it out. Read The Big Short. And let me know what you think about it. We're going to have a Phil Pritchett history lesson in our next segment with Blake Walker, Walker, Texas Road Manager, next.
I was dreaming for just a minute there, it was all so real. For just a minute she was standing there with me.
Fans, Romans, countrymen, lend me your ears. It is Phil Pritchett here on the P2 Podcast, enlightening your musical life as you look for direction in this chaotic music world. coming to you from Trinidad World Recording Studios, my beautiful studio here in beautiful Fort Worth, Texas. He has returned this week, folks. He has been out there milling around in the hallway, pouring himself some coffee, just sort of fumbling around, waiting to come in here and opine to join the discussion of the podcast this week. As he did last week, he returns to us. Blake Walker, my old road manager. Walker, Texas road manager, is here. Hello, Walker.
Hello, hello.
Welcome back. Welcome back to the confines. So good to see you again.
It's good to be back.
Well, last week we talked about, what else? Soccer, Frisco, Title IX, scholarships in collegiate sports.
Oh, yeah.
Walker, always bringing in, God, just all kinds of topics, man. All kinds of topics.
Useless information to discuss.
It's not useless, man. It's useless. You got kids. I got kids. We're trying to figure this all out, you know. And, well, Walker wanted to hear more about it. He was on me the other night in Frisco. I'm sitting there trying to eat my BLT, my free sandwich there at Lockridge. Thank you, Lockridge. Loved it. Loved it. Pabst Blue Ribbon, $2, you know. Good scene. Walker's like, man, I want to hear more about the Pritchett early years, man, the pre-full band years. Am I right? What would you say?
Absolutely. For the P2 nerds out there, like me, and I would consider myself to be the king of the P2 nerds.
Right.
To be an expert in all that is Phil Pritchett and the full band.
Yes, indeed.
But there is little known information about the early years of one Phil Pritchett. And we hear a lot about Romantic Embargo and the Reza Dudes and the Frat Boy days and just little snippets.
Yeah,
but
right,
we never
right.
really...
Where did it all start?
Cover bands and, you know, we've gotten a little bit out of the podcast, but I wanted to dive deeper into that realm.
Like maybe, like you were saying, maybe some sort of a time frame, something like that.
Yeah.
Of course, I've alluded to my parachute pants... past and stuff like that. Well, all right then. Well, here we go. Here we go. Get out your you can just draw a straight line from left to right on a paper, like a timeline. I never really know that. I can never remember the years that well, but about 7th grade, got my first guitar.
The year was 1943.
Yeah, 1940. I think it's more like 1985 maybe. So, man, I got my Dean, my star-shaped red Eddie Van Halen-type guitar, parachute pants, zebra shirt, sleeveless, and I was in a band called Violation. L-A-Y, Violation.
Please say you have
like
pictures.
Like we got laid all the time. It wasn't my idea. We got pictures.
Those have to be put up somewhere.
And there was this guy from Green Hill Music School. He was the music teacher at Green Hill, John Swafford. He was a music teacher. He would come to your house and give you a lesson. And, he could teach anything like bass, guitar, drums. He would teach me. What was cool about it was he didn't teach me like theory and scales and stuff. He said, man, well, what do you want to play? I said, man, I want to play Judas Priest and all this, you know, breaking the law, breaking the. So he taught me down, 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 down. He taught me that. Then he'd go to my friend Travis Ormond's house, who played bass, and he'd teach Travis that song on the bass. Then he'd go to Morgan Mayberry, my other friend's house, and teach him how to play on the drums. And then we formed a band.
Nice.
So we were this band, Violation, and we all had one teacher. And we all had separate private lessons from him. And so when we got together, we'd have three or four songs we could try and play. So that was my initiation into it, man, 7th, 8th grade. Then, we played a few birthday parties and stuff.
So was there anyone in your family that was a musician, like on like hobby-wise? Or
you know, my mom sang and played guitar a little bit. She went to college in New York. She went to Manhattan College, a small college up there in the College of Mount St. Vincent. Small Catholic girls' school, New York, you know. But she was really into like Joan Baez and kind of the folky stuff at the time. My mom was famously at the airport in New York when the Beatles landed, 1964.
Wow. She was screaming.
Yeah,
and holding
screaming.
Arms out.
Went over to the Plaza Hotel and she said, "There's nobody there." We just stood outside the front door of the Plaza because we knew they were staying at the Plaza. But then this crowd formed. The policeman came up, held their hands, and she said, "Man, I was right there." And the door opened, and they just hopped out. Just the Beatles, you know, ran in there.
Wow.
She kind of reached out and grabbed one of them. You know.
That's awesome.
And her friend, this is a different story. She had this friend from New York, Maggie Marazzo. She was just this, you know, college gal. And her father was from this, like, distinguished, New England family.
And Maggie Meraza was on the cover of Time magazine, the Beatle Invasion. Or there's a picture of her in there, like grabbing, like jumping into the trunk of the Beatles, trying to grab their guitars, just screaming. And it was her, just her dad was just a little embarrassed, like,
so proud.
Yeah, just screaming her head off. So that was Mom's claim to fame. So I heard these stories growing up about the Beatles and all this, you know, and Mom could play. So I was always really enamored with it. There's a guitar in the house. And so I took some lessons in seventh grade. So that was Violation.
Violation.
Yes, yes, learning all the Eddie Van Halen licks. Nice. So then we get into, man, I finally got into, like, you know, kind of U2, the Police, stuff like that.
Oh, yeah.
And some cooler stuff like that. You know, like the Smiths, and it's just like cooler stuff. Like, man, we were sick of the heavy metals. It was like, these guys, you know, we're sick of this. And then hooked up with Wes Cunningham and a couple other guys. We made All in One.
All in One. This is a high school.
All in One. High school. Yeah, we were all original. That was the deal. Ninth grade, we were just like, man, we've got to be all original. We've got to write all of our own songs. Yes. We were really into the Beatles. We wore ties to look like the Beatles.
I love it.
And we had a big article in the Park City's People, like a little Park City's paper.
Tell me
Park
you
paper.
Have that.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, great.
Me in a tie. We all dressed like the Beatles, and we sang, you know, Twist and Shout and stuff. But we sang our own songs, too. And we played in the high school talent show. I mean, we played all the time, all kinds of parties and stuff like that.
Like paying gigs?
Yeah, man. Oh, yeah. We'd go out and play birthday parties and church dances and, I mean, anything.
That's awesome.
You know, of course, we'd gotten into kind of like chewing tobacco and stuff, you know, so we were kind of rebellious a little bit.
Some of us never let it go.
Some of us have never quit. Good grief. Blake Walker, you need to get help. You need to get help.
I need rehab.
I called Walker out at Frisco the other night.
Brutal.
Playing Snuff Machine. Just look at him. He's still over there dipping. We play it as a joke now, Snuff Machine. Walker just can't let it go. Of course, none of those guys have let it go, really, have they?
No.
Yeah. Oh, man.
So ninth grade, you're getting paid playing gigs
a little bit,
and writing your own music.
A little bit, yeah. Oh, and we made a tape, All in One, made a tape, a couple tapes. Oh, they're out there. I've got one in here.
Nice. I remember a couple years ago, if you downloaded when P2 Tunes first came out, the first record, if you downloaded it off P-Tunes, you got a whole album. Uh-huh. Of some old band you were in. And I want to say it was
maybe
Romantic.
Romantic Embargo.
Yeah, it was Romantic
maybe.
Embargo. Yeah. That
so,
was cool.
Yeah, so we had that's coming up in college. That was Romantic Embargo. So All in One was four of us in ties playing Beatle-ish originals. That was a few years. And then so after that, Wes Cunningham, the main guy in All in One, my good friend, who you know, great songwriter, saying that he was on the podcast, Wes, you know, went on to sign with Warner Brothers. So that band kind of broke up, and then we went to the Suburbans, which was Wes on guitar. I moved to bass, and then we had Mark Baker on drums. And Baker was a real musician, you know. He was in the marching band. He had long hair. He didn't have a bunch of tattoos yet, but he soon would. And you know, he kind of hung out on Freak Street, we call it, you know, with the dudes, with the goth, and kind of smoking before school.
Yeah.
Just Mark Baker. I'd gone to Sunday school with Baker. Nice. So I knew him, and we were kind of buddies, but we kind of diverged in different paths in high school. But here we were kind of junior, senior year of high school. He was the drummer, and, man, he was really, really good, and he was into, like, Soundgarden and all that kind of stuff.
Oh, yeah.
So Cunningham and all his original songs, I was writing songs, singing harmony, playing bass. And so we were like a real band, like, senior in high school. You know, I wrote Katarina in that band. That was, like, one of our songs.
Oh, yeah. That's a great song. The Babysitter song?
Yeah. That was a Suburbans tune, you know.
Was Alive on 35 a Suburbans tune?
No, that was Romantic Embargo.
Romantic Embargo. Okay, I remember.
So we're getting to Romantic Embargo. So anyway, the Suburbans were so that was late high school.
No, so you said the drummer's long hair, you know, Zeppelin, smoked cigarettes. So you guys had crew cuts and...
No, we were
khakis
kind of
on
I mean Cunningham was, Cunningham drove like an old truck and had a leather jacket, you know.
Yes,
dude, I was on the golf team. I was just
you had the sweater tied around your
dude. It was well, you know, my folks were just my great parents were so supportive of me and everything. But man, it started. There was some tension, man. Junior senior year because you know I'd get upset when I didn't play good at golf. I'd be like, God, you know, but I was spending time. With the band, I was rehearsing and writing songs and sleeping in the studio and making albums. And they just wanted to know. So there was kind of a big moment with Mom and Dad at some point. I was kind of like, hey, you know, I just want you, man, I'm into music. I like it. And, they were like, okay, you know, once I kind of really laid on the table that, hey, you know, I just like doing it and maybe I'm not a great golfer, but I don't care and whatever.
Yeah.
So, you know, there was a little bit of that, I think. And,
did you guys play any clubs or any bars?
Oh man. Yeah. We played Deep Ellum, a couple times. God, just illicit parties where guys would have. Remember the old Coors Party Ball?
Oh, no.
Yeah. That was before your time. It was a plastic ball of Coors-like beer in a box. You poured ice over it, and that was the party.
What year was that?
It had a little keg tap thing on it.
Oh, no. I never even...
Late 80s, but I remember being at a couple of parties like, dude, we got a party ball, man.
Now it's official.
Like, what? Yeah. So, but back then, it was like playing at the theater gallery or... God, we did like one gig there and some places like that.
Did you get to open for anybody legit? Or
no,
do you remember?
Man. We played like big stuff like... what was it? Like Opera Now and big, man, like the Park City's Baptist Church dances and stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Talent shows.
Very
and
cool.
I remember recorded. I remember we just recorded a lot. We made 3 or 4 tapes. So just people knew our music. I just walked around high school with a shoebox with tapes on there. Hey, man, you want to buy a tape? $5, you know?
It's awesome.
So I was always selling. And so I was, man, doing it like that. And, man, we'd recorded a ton. So I just got used to singing in the studio, listening back to myself in headphones and playing bass and singing harmony. And even though and that was where I really learned, I'd quit taking lessons. I mean, I only took like maybe 6 months of lessons maybe from Swofford, John Swofford back in seventh grade. And then I was just kind of self-taught, you know, just because I was playing those Beatles songs and stuff. So then college, yeah. Is this running long? Timeline. We're going on a timeline. Pritchett timeline here.
How did we end up with Georgetown? What were your options? Where did you want to go?
To go to college?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Was it a music-inspired endeavor?
No. We had there was a big, tearful, terrible breakup of the Suburbans when we went to college.
No.
Well, you know, we all graduated. We all went to the different West, went to Baylor. I went to Southwestern, and Bake went to North Texas.
Okay.
So we were like, man, we're going to try to keep it going. Because, man, we had stuff going. We had little labels and stuff chasing us around, going, dude, we need to sign you guys and stuff. Like, because we were good. You know, we were only like 18. And we had real songs. We had original songs and had made a lot of music ourselves. And so we had big ideas, you know, but we knew we had to go to college. And
yeah,
I don't know. I think we played a couple times in college and it just wasn't working out freshman year.
Yeah.
So we were like, we just let it go. And I told myself I wouldn't miss it, you know, because I was in the college thing and all that. But it was hard to leave after
but
a while.
Doesn't Southwestern have a big music program? Mm. And is that not a...
Man, not really. That wasn't a consideration.
Okay, that didn't have anything to do with it.
Nah, I just went there because, man, I just got to drive around and meet people and, you know, hanging out, drinking beer, playing pool. I was like, dude, this is great. But I went and visited all the East Coast schools. I mean, I visited a little schools out there like Wofford and Furman, Richmond in Virginia, Wake Forest...
Wow.
And applied to all those.
Such an HP kid.
I got into Swanee. I got into Rhodes.
God, see, it's,
yeah. I got into Baylor.
Public school Dallas kids. Yeah. Like we never even thought about. Yeah. I mean, you basically had A&M, Texas Tech, TCU, yeah. Baylor, SMU.
I was out on the tour. So I'd visited all these schools, and then was just kind of like, I don't know where I was going to go. Really. I didn't have a firm opinion. And then I went and visited with my friend Chip Evans, who was an all-in-one. We went down and visited Southwestern, which I'd never heard of.
Yeah.
And it was just small, and we stayed in this room with these two funny guys. They took us out. You know, we just played pool. And we just had a great time. I was like, dude, let's just go to school here, you know. So that's where we went. So
that's awesome.
That was about all that factored into it. And then in college, so I kind of quit the music deal. And then the big thing was, I kind of get into Keen and stuff, like the country kind of more stuff in college. And, I'd kind of just said, man, I'll just forget music. You know, I'm just in college and stuff. So once like my senior year for Christmas, man, I got that guitar.
Your senior year of college?
Acoustic guitar. Yeah.
Wow. We just jumped freshman to senior year. No music in between?
Not really. No.
Wow.
I mean, just goofing around, jamming in the house with a couple other guys that played.
Yeah.
There was a guy named Mike DeGuzman in college that played, like Indigo Girls and U2 and stuff. but I could play. There wasn't a lot of guys who could play. And, I was in charge of like our drunk fraternities act, you know. And so I had to come up with something for that every year. So we did the Stones 1 year. We did Guns N' Roses 1 year. And I was just the lead guy out there.
Love it.
All that stuff. So that was a blast. I mean, So I was just having fun with it. But yeah, my folks out of nowhere give me this, you know, nice acoustic guitar for Christmas. I'm just like, wow, what the, you know, and man, just had it in my room, you know, and man, really started playing a lot and hooked up with my friend James DeWitt, who's, and the two of us formed Romantic Embargo. And we were a great acoustic duo, man. Started playing around Austin and playing in Georgetown just on campus. And I was the straight guy. I was just the guy who stood there and played. And then DeWitt was just crazy. Like, he'd throw his guitar off and just jump out in the crowd and start doing this hula hoop dance. And we had songs like, and we co-wrote. We got together and wrote a guy. We had songs like My Girlfriend's Getting Married and all this great, funny stuff. You know, we played, you know, played Drink When I Think and Rolling. I'd written with my friend Chip, like just any fun kind of party music.
Yeah.
And then he had his own songs, but then I kind of wrote like, in that time I wrote, Beautiful Day, and I wrote Meet Me in Las Vegas, stuff like that. So I kind of had some more serious kind of things, and so Romantic and Barbie, we made a live tape called Cut Me Some Slacks. That was a live album recorded at Southwestern University.
Love it.
And then we also did and then we went to Patrick McGuire's here in Arlington and did a CD, recorded a whole album in one day.
Wow.
And those were the first versions of Katarina with that band and Meet Me in Las Vegas, Rolling, Drink When I Think, stuff like that.
So you're the party fun guy, but managed to dig into some depression to write Meet Me in Las Vegas.
Well, I think that's
like
what,
21, 20 years old.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah. So it just kind of opened my eyes to it. And by that time, we'd had like Jack Ingram come play at our fraternity party for some dance. So here's this guy up here. I mean, he's just kind of strumming. I mean, he was a nice guy, but I was looking up there like, man, I could. Not, you know, he's not, I could do
I
that
can
too.
Do that.
No. But I was just like, man, I knew we were paying him like freaking $2,000 or so. I was like, dude, he's $2,000 for this? Good Lord. You know, I was just like, you know, he's just doing some Waylon songs. He did a Willie song and
did he have
some
any
of his. And,
was he did he have an album out or any of his
Oh, yeah.
Stuff?
Oh, people, we knew Jack. Yeah.
Okay.
He'd just done a couple albums. He was from SMU. I mean, he'd been out for a couple of years, but he was playing around, you know, and.
You guys are close to the same age, right?
Yeah, I was maybe a junior, senior, and he'd been out a year or two. I mean,
okay.
Yeah, he's a few years older than me. But so anyway, my eyes just got kind of open to that. And then James, the other guy in the band, that summer after college, I mean, I met my wife. So, man, I was getting married. I was kind of moving on. And James was still kind of young and or he just was, you know, he was still like kind of touring and traveling around Europe all summer and hanging out, and I was ready to just say, hey man, I'm ready to start playing and start doing my own thing. So that's kind of when I quote unquote went solo and made my Phil World, and that, you know, but I had a lot of those old All in One and Suburban songs and Romantic Embargo. I kind of already had a repertoire of Katarina, Drink When I Think, you know, some stuff that worked, you know.
Yeah.
And so I think a lot of guys today are, you know, start playing probably in college. They try to write their first 10 songs in college, and some of them aren't very good and stuff, but I'd already written a bunch of dumb songs I never finished in like 6th, 7th, 8th grade.
Nice.
And so I think that helped me a lot because I kind of had this built-in filter. Like, you know, my first album was Phil World, and none of those songs just stink, I don't think. You know?
No,
they all.
Great.
I mean, yeah, it was just Skywalker and Time Equals Distance and Dishwater Hands, Maria. You know, I knew what a good song was for me. If something was working, I was like, okay, that'll be a good tune,
yeah.
You know?
That's a very...
You develop that sixth sense, I think, you know.
That album, it kind of describes the party vibe, the fun live songs. I mean,
very country, you know. A lot of steel guitar on it. And
when guys come up to the booth, they're like, well, what should I buy? And I can look at what they're wearing. Ooh. If they're just, you know, starch jeans and cowboy hat.
Right,
I'm like,
right.
You at least need this. I always hand them The Phil Comes Alive because it's very Texas.
Yeah, that was
country.
Our second one. Yeah, we did that. And, well, see, I didn't have any recorded stuff of those old songs. So the reason we did Phil Comes Alive second... And we did Drink When I Think. Those were those old songs, but that was pretty much our set though. But I didn't have any of them on a CD of my under my own name. Does that make sense? So we did, you know, Antarctica USA was a Romantic Embargo. All that stuff was kind of older.
So how'd you get the first guys to form your band? If you went out on your own, did you just go?
Well, my first drummer was Baker from the Suburbans.
Okay.
He now lived in Austin, so he was my first drummer, and a guy named Kevin Jecker. Played bass, and I just found him. He showed up at a gig, had never met me before, with his bass, and just followed along.
Awesome.
Played.
Awesome. I love those stories.
Yeah. Oh, we're running out of time here in this segment.
Let's just make it another one.
Oh, jeez. More next week?
Absolutely.
More next week with the Phil timeline. We'll talk about, oh, I don't know. I'll bring y'all up to speed on my career, whatever. Where we've been, where we might be going. I get questions about, now, what album was before this? Who played on this? So that's the purpose of all this stuff, folks. I hope you find it useful and enlightening. Blake Walker has been here again this week. Thank you, Walker, for dropping by, for lending your insight, and for keeping me on point on the Phil Pritchett timeline this week. Oh, it's exhausting. Down memory lane with Blake Walker. Well, stay tuned, folks. I'm going to stagger over to the vault here, rummage through the records, try to pull out some gold for you, take a listen, tell you what I think in the vault next. Come on, that kicks ass. Fans, Romans, countrymen, lend me your ears. Phil Pritchett here on the P2 Podcast. Oh, man. You didn't think you liked the Kinks, but you do, don't you? Oh, the Contenders. That track right there kicks off our subject for the vault today, fans. What is it called? It's a heck of a long title. Lola vs. Power Man. Part 1, Lola vs. Power Man. The Kinks, dude. Man, I did a Kinks episode a little while back with my good friend Buddy Huffman of Macon, Grayson fame. We talked, that was the only vault I think we did just a very general idea. We talked about the Kinks just kind of as a whole. But they've been a band for a long time, man. And I don't know if they're still technically together. I don't know. I don't think so. But British brothers Ray Davies, head songwriter. Then he has his brother Dave Davies, lesser... prominent in the band, I think it's safe to say. But man, Dave, over the years, I've noticed, has some of the songs I like the best, man. Dude wrote Picture Book Taken of Your Mother. He's written some great stuff, man. Famous brotherly deal. You know, a lot of fistfights backstage, a lot of drinking and craziness. You know, Ray Davies. Of course, the Kinks, we all know their early stuff. You really got me, girl, you really got me now. But this is kind of more in the 70s here, the Kinks. They did some very experimental stuff. Man, made some weird, difficult-to-digest records. Very glammy and showbizzy and weird. But part one, Lola vs. Power Man, is not one of them. That was the Contenders. Well, man, speaking of the great songwriting abilities of brother Dave Davies... He wrote and sings this next song. I think we played it on the podcast back at when Buddy was in here. Not sure, but I love this song. Stu Wiley told me that the band Golden Smog, which is a band comprised of Jeff Tweedy of Wilco and Gary Loris of the Jayhawks, kind of a side project band. He goes, man, they recorded that Stranger song. They recorded it. And I was like, dude, no, you're mistaken. No. But Stu Wiley proved me wrong. I didn't realize they had recorded this great song. On one of their records, greatness, man. This is Strangers, the Kinks, on the P2 Podcast. I want all you songwriters to listen to that track again. And next time you come to Trinidad, just say, hey, man, I listened to Strangers by the Kinks like 50 times. I've got it down. I see what's going on. I took just some of the general ideas and I made my own song. Kind of in that same ilk. Of course, you're not, you know, covering it or copying from it. Just be inspired by the greatness, those chord changes, the melody. So great, man. Kinks, like any good band, they can just melt your heart with a song like that and then come right back and just kick you in the teeth. Boom! I aspire to nothing less in my own band. Trying hard to always balance out that dynamic, man. So much pressure just to make a bunch of mid-tempo songs that might get played on the radio. Garbage! Garbage, I say. Dynamic, man. All the great bands have dynamic. Slow and low and soft Led Zeppelin. And then they rock it on the next one. No one just goes at 10 the whole time. Only a few bands. AC/DC can pull it off. No ballads. But other than that, you got to have some good down stuff. But speaking of rocking it, man, Power Man. Oh, dude. Power Man, he's out there. We all know who he is. Power Man, the Kinks. Check it out.
same old story.
Fans, Romans, countrymen, lend me your ears. Phil Pritchett here on the P2 Podcast. Bring the full band to your home, your festival, your club, whatever. All you got to do is call me, 817-733-5256, or email me, phil@philpritchett.com. Buy the whole catalog for $20 at P2 Merch or P2Tunes.com. Download those records for $4. The new Antarctica USA t-shirt is here. Willie Earl Nolan on the mountain. Welcome to Antarctica USA. Order off the website today. It's $15. $16 includes shipping. I mail it right out. Send me an email ahead of time. Say, Phil, can you sign my shirt? I'll sign it. I ship it all myself by hand. Shipping by hand here at Trinidad. Well, thanks for joining us on this week, folks. Thanks for Blake Walker coming by for a little Phil Pritchett chronology history lesson. So fun. Taking me down memory lane there. We're going to leave you with the namesake, the title track, so to speak, of this Kinks record that is so badass it makes me cry. Lola. Man, I didn't even know what this song was about till I was like 28 years old. So disturbing, but so great. Lola. We'll see y'all next week on the podcast. Much tougher.
I met her in a club down in Old Soho, where you drink champagne and it tastes just like Coca-Cola. C-O-L-A Cola. She walked up to me and she asked me to dance. I